Facebook at certain moments had that, or certain message boards did, but they were all within walls. When it's a free, completely open space, imitating a public square, it's a bordel. It's a it's just like a mess, right?
Yeah, but what does it mean, imitating a public square? I mean, that would be chaos, you know, just people shouting at each other randomly.
But that's what social media is, basically, right? It's like most of social media is unwalled and just a kind of a free-for-all where you shout into space, and maybe you have a conversation with someone, and then someone else comes along and goes, hey, you're a fascist, you're a racist, and you're like, whoa, where did the hell did you come from? Were you listening to what we were saying, right? So it's like that. If you were to put it into meat space, that's what it would look like. So anyway, my point about you know, to return to Habermas, is just that, yeah, it's a kind of ironic realization of his vision, which hasn't turned out right. So he needs to then step back and go, okay, we need to put some rules around this thing, right? To appeal to some authority, yeah. to go, how do we actually have democratization of media and to provide for, you know, true deliberative communication. Hello, BungaCast, Reading Club. This is what we're doing today. This is the Global Politics Podcast at the end of history, if you don't know by now. This is the Reading Club exclusively for patrons in the Grand Corruption tier and our benefactors as well at the State Capture tier. We are your bitch and eternally grateful for it. We are going to be continuing this 2024 Reading Club. It's the second edition. And we are going to be dealing with, well, one of the themes, right? So we've got three themes for the Reading Club for the start of the year, which we're orienting our reading around and well, your reading and your listening around, which is Russia, past and present, the rise and fall of nations, and intellectuals, or rather the intelligentsia and the public. And the book we're dealing with today falls very squarely in that category. Already the previous one, which we discussed last week, or rather last month, Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities, also relates and touches upon this notion, discusses the relationship between the intelligentsia and the public in the rise and fall of nations. But today we're dealing with a kind of a, what is it, George, a re-up of a classic? Why don't you tell us?
Yeah, it's a gritty, dark reboot by... Jürgen Habermas.
Sequelitis. Sequelitis hits even German critical theory.
Yeah, I mean, Marx started off with Capital. Like, how many volumes would he have done? He would have been churning them out as his kind of tentpole summer blockbuster every year.
Aren't we all in the Capital extended universe?
Yeah, I guess we are. It's taken over now. And it's, you know, no signs of stopping, even though the products it's churning out are worse.
But there's a new translation of Capital coming out. I saw yesterday, which people are excited about and talking up as not just a thing for Marxologists, but should be a thing. I don't know. I don't know if you have any insight into this. Well,
I hadn't heard about that. I have to say it doesn't fill me with enthusiasm. What was wrong with the old Lawrence and Wishart old Penguin ones?
Or really? Indeed, yeah, Lawrence and Wishart and Penguin. And I remember, like, you had that Lars T. Lee, you know, that moment of Lenin scholarship with Lars T. Lee, where right. he kind of said that there was, if we change the, you know, if we understand the interpretation of particular words like consciousness and vanguard and professional and so on in Lenin's writings, we have an entirely new, different understanding of Lenin, and that's going to transform, you know, everything, in fact.
Yeah.
Guess what?
I mean,
it kind of didn't change. It didn't actually change anything at all. So it's hard to see like what difference shift in emphasis or, you know, more a kind of modernized German translation or modernized translation of German is going to of Marx's 19th century German, what difference it's really going to make. So
yeah, but you can imagine already the blurb, like this new translation, which gives us insights into how to solve the crisis of democracy and address climate change and sort of thing. And it's going to be like, well,
that's
actually,
right. That's exactly what it will be.
Actually, if you think this means value form rather than value container or something, then I don't know. Sorry,
that's
I shouldn't
right,
be
yes.
so.
No, that's
such
right.
A dilettante,
that is
really.
That is exactly what
they
it
might,
will be like.
They might
that
give
is exactly what
riz,
it will be like,
though. You know, might have some riz.
But if you understand the value, like George says, if you understand the value container, then actually you will see that Marx believed in deep ecology, like from 1830. In fact,
Alex, did you say it will have some riz?
Well, I say he might give Marx riz, and maybe make that superstructure really based. So
all these things
to look forward to.
One superstructure is already based because they interpenetrate dialectically. Read Jakubowski or whatever. Secondly, Marx already had riz, right? He was a very charismatic person, from what I can tell. Mm. But yeah, you know, you can always take that riz up to the next level. Also, I would imagine.
Well, I guess he had to riz up his patron.
This kind of new translation will clearly show that campus is the battleground of revolutionary politics and climate change.
I mean, campus just means field, right, from Latin.
Yeah,
so
well, there you go.
It is the
and
field
climate
of
change,
struggle.
Climate change is the central contradiction of capitalism and always has been. So,
yeah,
memory
I mean, We can still hope that all those academics on campuses will go to a different sort of field when we get the chance to put them out for some agricultural labor. No offense to any of our patrons who are academically, I was going to say inclined,
or indeed if they're agricultural laborers. No
yeah.
offense.
That no, we actually like those patrons
right.
of ours.
Right.
Sorry, I should actually bring us back on track a little and say, what is this book that we're going to be discussing? Yes, so it's Jürgen Habermas's A New Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere and Deliberative Politics. So as Alex did allude to, this is a reboot of Habermas's 1962 book, and we'll get into that in a bit. And it's much shorter than that earlier book, which, as Habermas actually notes, is still his most popular. I would say it's more of an essay with some kind of clarificatory material than the kind of theoretical opus that he's more known for. So a bit of biographical detail on Habermas, just to kick things off. So he was born in Dusseldorf in Germany in 1929. His father was a Nazi sympathizer and leader of the Cologne Chamber of Industry and Commerce. And Habermas himself found himself in the Hitler Youth at age 15. And
I think the point is he was conscripted, George. He didn't like, you know, kind of, like it was a wild night out. And then the next morning I like found myself in a Hitler Youth club.
Or indeed that he was lost and then he joined the Hitler Youth and he really found himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could have been how I meant it. Like in a not Heideggerian way, but he actually discovered his true calling I can't remember what the name of the sort of Hitler Youth that he was in, but I think there is, you know, you don't want to kind of generalize or take too much from this youthful experience of his, but the German war experience is certainly not completely unconnected to one of the, I would say, guiding political projects of Habermas's work, which is this, I guess, attempt to think beyond German nationalism. How do German theorists, German historians reckon with their country's past? And for Habermas, this was in the development of a series of theories about, I guess, cosmopolitanism, transnationalism, and a kind of a turn towards Europe. That's not what this book's about, but I think that is a useful bit of context for listeners.
But also, I mean, it's you know, kind of it's rehabilitation and reconstruction for Germany. So not, you know, not it's not just a reckoning with the past, but an active process. I mean, Habermas is a very old man, and he's seen a lot of the 20th century. He has indicated by the fact he was conscripted into the Hitler Youth in the closing days of the Second World War. And so a lot of his life, you know, was the post-war period between, you know, between the end of the Second World War and German reunification. And so that's the period of kind of reconstruction, rehabilitation, the German economic miracle, and then reunification and everything that has come since. So only to stress, you know, it's not just a kind of a historical reconstruction, but you know, in so much as his philosophical project has political dimensions, it was a very active part of building the Federal Republic, at least intellectually.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I think, you know, I actually probably missed the buried the lead, or like, he was born in, you know, 1929, so he's now in his mid-90s. And given that, as I'll explain in a bit more detail, this book is essentially about social media, this is, you know, he has seen, you know, this isn't his first book that he's writing as a, you know, a kind of a youngster. He's seen the, as you were saying, Phil, the progression of, you know, of the 20th century, and, you know, probably one of the, I would say, oldest still writing critical theorists or philosophers. I don't know any off the top of my head, and I, you know, should probably have searched for some to evidence this point.
Yeah, but there, yeah, is there anyone, maybe our listeners can tell us if there's anyone kind of waiting to inherit the mantle, inherit the crown. I imagine we probably would have heard of them if there was somebody who is kind of anointed heir for Habermas. So I imagine there probably isn't, but, you know, like I say, our listeners should indicate if they do know.
Yeah, some up and coming 89-year-old who's just waiting for Habermas to
toiling in the erudition mines and waiting to emerge into the light, kind of
very
blinking.
Much so.
Yeah.
No, I mean, but this idea of inheritance or taking up the mantle. I mean, this is Habermas's, I guess, position within German critical theory. He joined the Frankfurt Institute for Social Research in 1956 as Adorno's research assistant, and probably is the most famous and celebrated member of his generation of critical theorists, which is, you know, essentially the one down from Adorno and Horkheimer. He had this famous critique of Dialectic of Enlightenment. We don't necessarily need to go into that in too much detail, but his you know, his output has been consistent since the 60s. He's, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, he did churn out, that sounds a bit dismissive, I mean, he did produce these, you know, key texts, weighty, The Theory of Communicative Action, Philosophical Discourse of Modernity, Legitimation Crisis, and I would say all of this is, you know, driven by his particular critique of Marxism, which becomes more noticeable, particularly after the Legitimation Crisis in the early 70s, and his, I guess, increasing movement towards his own distinctive theory, which is one based in reason and discourse, and, you know, we'll kind of get into this and its implications very shortly. So yeah, just finally then, in terms of the, you know, the background of this, you know, this famous figure, is that he, particularly in German, he's one of the most famous public intellectuals in Europe today. Comments on all political issues, pretty much. Well, not all, but he certainly has hit the news again on Israel and Palestine with his comments. So I guess it's, you know, all of this essentially takes a step back. You have this, you know, this isn't necessarily his, he's not a communications scholar specifically, although he's obviously written this influential book in the early 60s. He's a philosopher, critical theorist, and turning his attention to essentially social media in this book. So onto the book itself. As I said, it's quite short. It's an easy read compared to some of Habermas's other stuff in the way that it's written. And the central question that he's got on his mind for this book is, what sort of political culture is required to sustain democracy? And specifically, what is the role of institutions of the public sphere and the media in producing, sustaining, or undermining this culture? So there's two very big ideas, I would say, in this, which come together in this book. And this is indicated, as I'll get into, in the structure of the book. The first is the public sphere. What is that? How does that change? The second is deliberative democracy. What is that? How do you need deliberation in order to have democratic decisions made? And I think this kind of perspective on deliberative democracy that underlies a lot of the argument in the book that you, or which comes through weakly, he doesn't kind of assert it too strongly, but that there is a serious reason to be concerned for democracy itself, and whether we have a democratic crisis or not is very much up for debate. So I think it's worth saying that the relationship between media on the one hand and democracy on the other, this is something which, you know, a lot of ink has been spilled on this topic, but I would say particularly, and we are some of the people who are perhaps guilty of spilling ink in this debate, but particularly around the relationship of social media to democracy, in explaining events like Trump, Brexit, the role of Russian bots and disinformation, how the liberal establishment, you might put it, responds to these events, and what this tells us about our politics. This is what we talk about in the end of history. We I think take a bit more of a critical approach than Habermas does. I realize I'm speaking on behalf of the two of you here, but we do develop this idea of neoliberal order breakdown syndrome in the book. Well, we developed it on the podcast and then put it in the book, where this is one of the classic explanations. Democracy isn't working. Why isn't it working? Because you've got all these flipping idiots on their social medias getting all their misinformations and then doing their bad voting. So there's more to it than that, but that's, you know, part of, I would imagine, what's stimulated this investigation from Habermas. So those are two big ideas, deliberative democracy and the public sphere. How is this book structured? I'll give you a quick readout of the table of contents. There's only three chapters, won't take too long. So the first is reflections and conjectures on a new structural transformation of the public sphere. So this is the central part of the book, which, you know, that even that title goes back to his 1962 book, and as Alex says, re-ups that classic, polishes it off, you know, dusts it down and reforms it for our social media age. The second chapter is deliberative democracy in interview. So this is an interview that Habermas did for the Oxford Handbook on deliberative democracy. And then third and finally, what is meant by deliberative democracy, objections and misunderstandings. So this is a foreword that Habermas wrote to a volume of interviews on deliberative democracy. So really the second and third chapters are clarifying, building out some of the points around the first chapter, because he really does approach this by looking at the public sphere and its implications on and for deliberative democracy rather than the other way around. To attack this kind of head on, the public sphere, what is this? What is this kind of term that we've already thrown around quite a bit, or I have in this intro? So the way that he develops this case for this, in case listeners haven't read this 1962 book, might be useful for me to give a bit of context, just to kind of bring that through a little bit. So yeah, the structural transformation of the public sphere. As I said before, this is Habermas's first book, but he notes in this one, it's still his most popular. Clearly hit a nerve or caught a mood. So what the public sphere is, I guess, in some ways a slightly a concept that might create a number of different sorts of mental images. And one thing that he's clear that the public sphere isn't is this kind of nebulous but quantifiable and measurable quote-unquote public opinion. This was the way that quantitative sociology and market research in the early 60s was increasingly sort of seeing the public sphere. You can go out, you know, you don't need to go into the public square, you don't need to go into kind of every cafe and salon. You can ask people their opinions on all these different things. You can develop some scales and you can kind of work this out. So instead of this kind of, I guess, quantitative market research approach, Habermas describes his own as a as putting the public sphere in sociological terms. That's his quote. So he integrates, or he positions the public sphere as having an important functional role within society. Specifically, it is between civil society and political systems, and it is the process of debate, discussion, private individuals gathering together and articulating the needs of society and the state that integrates citizens. So this is an important idea for Habermas, because it's the process through which citizens come to be integrated into the political system. It's through this process of debate, discussion, and disagreement. So kind of like society as a universal podcast, you might say. So this is one of the classic sort of mediating institutions that you might say stand between the people on one side and the state on the other. And Habermas states this, the emergence of this, both this, the reality of this public sphere, and in classic German critical theory terms, also society's awareness of this part of itself to the 18th century, and argues quite extendedly that this is involved in the development of a, I guess, a society that's sort of starting to understand itself as a, you know, democratic entity, as a form of not organism, but a sort of thing that can be ruled by reason, and specifically, as it turns out, by the bourgeoisie. So just to kind of take a step back, this is the, you know, the public sphere. This is one of Habermas's main concepts from his most popular book. We talked last time about Anderson, Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities. There he articulates this model of print capitalism developing national consciousness. So the idea there is you have this specific language, which is between Latin on the high level, vernacular on the low level, which through which citizens of a society essentially speak to each other. And then you can imagine that other people exist in your nation, and you come up with these ideas and these mental conceptions and these imaginings of communities which become national. So both accounts surely have flaws, but because I think you both have read Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, and if you haven't, apologies for putting you on the spot. But what do you make of the kind of comparison between the Andersonian model of the people and the intelligentsia and the Habermasian one, given this is the theme of our one of the three themes of our reading club?
Yeah, I it's a good question. I guess there's it's a tricky one as well. There's a different inflection, I suppose, to there's a different inflection to the Anderson compared to the Habermas. The Habermas does, I never read all of Structural Transformation. I read kind of the undergraduate sampling of it, which I think was the first couple of chapters. Maybe it was a very long time ago now. But from what I recall, it has that, it's setting out the conditions for a very specific conception of what the public is, which is the area, it's very kind of intimately connected with a bourgeois notion of society. So it has that kind of normative inflection in a way that Anderson's investigation doesn't. And Anderson's investigation of his kind of anthropological, historical kind of unpicking of the rise of print capitalism, it doesn't quite have that sense of it, of the creation of this public sphere, but rather how people think about how they relate to each other as a result of the development of a certain kind of technology. And the kind of class isn't exactly right, but the kind of the different strata are built into the theory in the Anderson, right? Because it's something which is pioneered by these middle kind of the petty elites, or these kind of middle strata, who then disseminate this model and kind of impose it as the default mode for how people relate to each other imaginatively in the new context of the nation. So, but I mean, clearly both kind of perform similar roles, right? Habermas, like you say, George, is very explicit that this is part of social integration. And that's also very clear in the Anderson that the formation of this vernacular language was also the way in which that happened in those contexts as well.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, again, this is from memory and a combination of memory and things that I've looked up about the 1962 book in advance of this recording to try to jog my memory a little bit. But I think my understanding, I think maybe similarly to Phil, is that the Anderson's account, particularly of print capitalism, isn't kind of riven with kind of tensions or contradictions. It's this thing that emerges that the bourgeoisie creates, and then it leads people to a change in consciousness amongst the public as a whole. Certainly the more kind of urban sections of the working class, more connected sections, and
yeah, begins, right down to the rest of society. He's big on the coffee houses, wasn't he, Habermas? Yeah.
But I mean, that was Anderson that I was referring to. Habermas, I think, like there's this tension where the role of communication and the creation of the public sphere, on the one hand, gives you a sense that you are performing not the role of the state, but you're somehow caring for public affairs. But it's fake, right? Because you're not really in charge of the state, of the real public thing. Well, at the same time, the process of democratic deliberation, of communication, is progressive and leads through tensions with the state and the demands it creates and so on. It leads to sort of progress. So there's an inherent kind of dialectic within the creation of the public sphere and of deliberation that pushes forward into time, but also pushes forward in terms of progress. And I think that's something which isn't there in Anderson's account.
Yeah, I guess you can kind of, sorry, go on.
Well, no, I think the question, I mean, we'll come on to this, but as communication becomes ever more central, right? And I think, there's people who talk about contemporary capitalism as communicative capitalism. I'm not going to say whether that, I think that's the right or wrong way to describe it, but I think it's just to make reference to it. We have ever more communication. Communication is ever more important. The system itself justifies itself through a lot of communication. There's a lot of communication going on. Always be communicating, as its advocates say. And so the question is, does all this communication lead somewhere or lead to something better?
What happens if we had a lot of ways to communicate but nothing to say? Makes you think, doesn't it? No, I mean, more seriously, I think you could make a very crude distinction or comparison between Anderson and Habermas in the following way. I was going to say Anderson and Habermas, which be a bit confusing. So Habermas's 1962 book, it does focus on these coffee shops, on these salons in France, on these, I guess, physical meeting places where the public meets. You have a public event. You know, this is formally open to everybody. It's inclusive. I mean, who actually turns up? Maybe this is, well, in historical actuality, it's the bourgeoisie. But this is important because it produces the sort of politics that comes out of it is a rationalist one. You debate, the best ideas win. It's also universalist. Everybody can be, everybody's part of the public. Everybody can be involved in this coffee house discussion. You know, Anderson, listeners can revisit the last month's reading club, but crude summary, instead it's books. What do? Books produce national consciousness. You don't have
in
to
in your head privately in reading head. Them. I mean, that's I think also a different important difference.
Yeah, I guess you most of the time you're reading a book yourself. You might be reading it out loud to a small group of people, but it's another person's monologue, which goes into a monologue in your head, if a novel at least, perhaps.
And it's all the religious pamphleteering of the German yes. Reformation as well. Kind of, it's not the civilized discussion of trade routes and establishing constitutional government or something like that. It's a very different kind of idea that's being implanted.
Yeah, and it's Martin Luther burning up the bestseller lists, as we talked about last time. But yeah, so instead of that kind of rational and universalist politics, it produces a national consciousness and potentially national politics. So I guess those are some of the distinctions. So the public sphere, what does it look like today? How has it been structurally transformed? I guess the kind of the TLDR from Habermas's perspective is that you have social media relegating traditional media to the background. This is a book on social media, or but not on the actuality or particularities of social media, but on the structural changes.
Is it that the extent of it? There's no kind of more complicated interaction. It's just like a hydraulic theory. One goes up and the other goes down. Social media goes up and traditional media goes down. And there's no kind of interrelationship between the two. Is that what you're saying?
I was giving you the George's gist there. I mean, but to get
and
into
I'm
it.
I'm following up on the George's gist with the Phil's fist. So tell me.
That's... yeah, I don't think we're gonna have that kind of
so tempted to patent that though. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I'm thinking like it's like you're watering down the squash now because you don't want to drink the concentrated Ribena. You know that's we might have done as a kid, but not anymore. No, there is. So he does talk a little bit about the changing. Again, I might be being unfair to him, and listeners who have read the book can berate me for that if it is the case, but he does talk a bit about the platform character of this new media. So this is a fundamentally changed relationship. It's this, you know, instead of being the passive kind of consumer of media, newspapers, particularly important in Anderson as well. He says, quote, the platform character of the new media is creating alongside the editorial public sphere, a space of communication in which readers, listeners and viewers can spontaneously assume the role of authors. And so why is this particularly important for Habermas? Because I said, you know, he wrote this book, Theory of Communicative Action. There is a fundamentally different position that you're in when you're communicating and being an active participant in that. Coming up with speech acts in that interaction rather than just receiving the messages yourself. But for me, that's not, you know, I don't read him as saying that's a qualitative difference. I think if you want to boil it down, it is fundamentally a hydraulic theory. There isn't a structural transformation. It's the structure is the same, but what's filling it, what's filling it is different. So this, so the public sphere, as a consequence, there is a change, because the, you know, what the contents of something are can change the effect of that thing. And indeed, that's what he, so I'll just move through the structure of the argument and then we can kind of broaden out to discuss some of the kind of political implications of this, in a bit. But yeah, so he starts off this chapter on the public sphere by looking at the relationship between normative and empirical theory, and we'll get into this, particularly around deliberative democracy. Then he talks about the democratic process in the light of deliberative politics, i.e. what do you need to have in terms of a deliberative process for something to be, I guess, understood as a democratic event or democratic process. Then he talks a little bit about the crisis tendencies of capitalist societies. And although this is an interesting, I liked this part of the book. We talked about legitimation crisis in a previous reading club. So we've actually covered, I think, in quite a lot of detail, Habermas's theories on crisis. Then he talks about these recent technological changes. So that kind of platform character and that shifting balance between social and traditional media. And then he essentially moves on to some recommendations, which we can discuss a little bit later as well, in terms of what do we do about this. But I think probably less important than what he actually says in detail is that there's always going to be requirements from a Habermasian point of view to regulate, if you want to use a euphemistic kind of word about it, to regulate what it is that the media and social media, traditional media, what it is that they can say, or what it is that can be, what that kind of process of producing opinion looks like, because it is so important to deliberative democracy. It is so important to what the inputs of democracy are. So in terms of that, to move on to this kind of the second big idea, of deliberative democracy. What is this for Habermas? So this is I should probably be straightforward at the outset and say I'm probably personally not that much of a deliberative Democrat, and I have thought about it, have deliberated on it, but that hopefully won't stop me from giving a fair portrayal of what Habermas says here.
Why don't you like deliberative democracy, George? What's wrong with it? Like, why do you hate democracy?
I don't. It's the deliberative bit, actually. I just don't like. I don't like thinking. It's overrated. No, I just think it's like you don't.
It's a good thing you're doing a reading club thing where you're talking us through Habermas.
Yeah, that's reading though. That's not thinking. That's just being a passive consumer. No, I mean, we can get into this in the discussion. I don't want to, you know, knock something down before I've built it or whatever the correct analogy would be. But I guess for me, just put my cards on the table, I don't think you don't need somebody to deliberate. You don't need to see them do it. You don't need to test any conditions in which they do it. Their expression of their democratic will in voting is sufficient for me for that to legitimate a kind of political event such as an election. Alex is shaking his head for listeners who aren't viewers, and he's going to tell us why you, the listener, are a stupid idiot and can't be trusted to make a democratic decision unless you make the same.
No, not that, exactly the opposite. But I think we're going to get onto this later. This isn't for now, right?
Okay. Well, we can pick that back up. But Phil did. Phil knew what the answer to that was, but he couldn't resist baiting me. Anyway, so back to this concept of deliberative democracy, just to return to the table of contents. This is the topic of the second and third chapter of the book, but these are more kind of, I guess, foundations or requirements for why is the public sphere so important. So deliberative democracy, and this is a quote from Habermas, and I think an important one, quote, depends on enlightened democratic will formation in the political public sphere. That's the kind of the nub of all of this, listener, is that in order for deliberative democracy to function, you need to have the public sphere operating in a way that produces an enlightened democratic will. So Habermas continues, quote, the media system, and he italicizes, or I'm sorry, if the translator of this book is listening, I haven't read it in German, so I don't know if the emphases are Habermas's or the translator's, but he says, or Habermas is translated, I should say, as saying, quote, the media system is of crucial importance for the role of the political public sphere in generating competing public opinions that satisfy the standards of deliberative politics. So when I was doing that emphasis, that's the italics. So the media system allows us to have opinions that are relevant in the sense of being essentially informed by the right sort of evidence and on the right sorts of things, and effective, i.e. being listened to and enacted through political representatives. And I guess I alluded to this earlier, but I think for me, the actuality of democracy in contemporary societies, I just don't think that those conditions, or really any conditions on public opinions, are required. I think you can be agnostic about where people's opinions come from. You just recognize those in the political process. So what's the central claim normatively of deliberative democracy? It's that the legitimacy of democratic decisions are based in deliberation. We'll come into what the quality of that deliberation is, rather than the aggregation of preferences in voting. So what sort of deliberation does this have to be? The context is important. There has to be the ability for those deliberating to be independent of unequal political power or undue influence. And citizens themselves have to be impartial, rational, and informed. So I guess you're sort of starting to build out an ideal theory here about how democracy can work under certain conditions. So I would say that what's particularly revealed in this book is how technocratic this view of deliberative democracy always ends up being. So Habermas says, quote, democratic elections must be understood as, I'm not going to keep doing that weird italicizing emphasis thing. I'm just going to read it in my normal voice. So he says, quote, democratic elections must be understood as the final stage of a problem-solving process, that is, as the result of a joint formation of opinion and will by citizens who first form their preferences in the course of a public, more or less rational debate over how to deal with the problems requiring political regulation. And then, in what I think is a very telling quote, and then I'll see what the two of you think on this, and we can return to the discussion started above as to whether we should be deliberative democrats or not. Habermas says, quote, the point of deliberative politics is, after all, that it enables us to improve our beliefs in political disputes and get closer to correct solutions to problems. So what do you guys think of this? Because, I mean, you know, we should at least have a deliberation about deliberative democracy, have a debate and an argument in our kind of salon, our coffee house that we have here virtually.
So, I mean, I don't think there's anything in and of itself disputable with what Habermas says. It's been the case since Rousseau that you need to have a process by which you generate the general will and not just have it be the will of all, right? So it's not just a bunch of individuals going together to the polls to cast a vote and then going back home. That precisely is the technocratic vision advanced by kind of neoliberal Democrats who justify democracy by the fact that there's a vote and lose out and miss out all the other important stuff that constitutes democracy, civic associations, debate, deliberation, free media, et cetera, all the rest of it, right? Democracy is not just voting. Whether we're talking about actually existing parliamentary democracy or indeed any notion of democracy that we might hold. Or any fulsome notion of democracy that we might hold. So I think, you know, there's no getting away from deliberation. It is about debate and forming opinion and testing your ideas and reforming them, persuading others, persuading your neighbors and your colleagues and your friends and your comrades of ideas. And that happens at many different levels, right? So I think it happens within political parties. It happens within local branches. It happens at a national level to the extent that you can have a national debate in the grand public sphere, which is, of course, subject to a lot of manipulation. There's a question about whether public opinion actually exists or is a figment of the technologists of public opinion, the marketers, the pollsters, the rest of them, which I think we should be very critical of. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean that deliberation in and of itself is something that we should dispense with or not aim for. No, it is the stuff of democracy. There is a problem. There's a limitation to how much deliberation you want to have or how much emphasis you want to theoretically place on deliberation. Because the thing is that at least in the Habermasian vision, it constantly gets down to like, well, okay, but the reality of deliberation is often manipulated, inadequate. People are pursuing their own instrumental aims within it and not, you know, participating in good faith and in an open communication, etc. Therefore, you need to do it this way, right? Okay, but then you have that discussion about how you want to deliberate. And that discussion about how you deliberate is itself subject to discussions about how you should be deliberating. And it's kind of recursive all the way down, and you get a lot of talking about talking about talking. And you don't want to do that because nothing happens then. So to be a little bit you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, deliberation is important, but it can't be everything, and it can't be the I think if it becomes the centerpiece entirely of your politics, that's a problem. Just to respond to what George said in your dismissal of deliberation, I think I read that as you just being defensive about people using quote unquote deliberation as a way instrumentally to delegitimize a democratic vote. But that is not, we shouldn't take them on good faith as them saying that, as them really being in favor of deliberation. The people who tried to undermine the vote for Brexit and overturn it are not in good faith talking about really about deliberation. They don't want debate. They don't want democracy. They don't want parties springing up. They don't want a fulsome democracy of the type of thing that the full Brexit was interested in driving through and using Brexit as an opportunity to drive through. So I think you're just being defensive about that.
You are making a very underhanded tactic, sir. in trying to appeal to our emotions over Brexit to smuggle in.
No, but George was already referring to Brexit.
Well, look, I'm sick and tired of having to talk about Brexit every single podcast.
Look, but anyway, the point is that If your argument against liberation is simply, oh, people just turn up to the vote, turn up to the polls, and that's good enough. Now, don't ask any further questions. I think you thereby undermine the case for democracy in and of itself.
Yeah. So my view, I guess, is I would agree with I think a lot of what Alex said. I suppose there are three kind of three moments that I would want to build out here. So you have the kind of the public space of the coffee house, which grows up in a very kind of a very specific context. That is transformed over the course of the 20th century into the mass media. And there you have kind of the construction of a public in a very different way. And in the context of mass opinion and mass public and the development of all the technologies that Alex mentioned. And then you have, since the decline of that era, the kind of television news and mass print kind of newspapers and the development of this kind of much more fragmented media platform kind of network-based model. And I think all of those things, those are three kind of important moments in the development of or the relationship between modern mass communication and the formation of kind of public will and public discussion. And each of those moments, I think, is worth kind of thinking through in terms of, in all sorts of dimensions, from the shift to face-to-face to the kind of imaginative connection that's produced in the context of mass politics with mass newspapers and so on, to, I guess, a format which can be more visual, as we're doing now, but it definitely isn't face-to-face and is this kind of patchwork of much more diffuse, I suppose, diffuse formations or nodes in which these discussions happen, but then influences, kind of reacts back on the mass media, because famously now, the newspapers take their headlines. They used to take their headlines from what was on, or rather the TV news would take their kind of pointers from the newspapers. Whereas now the TV news and the newspapers take their pointers from, whatever's trending on social media, whatever.
On TikTok.
And indeed, TikTok is
Twitter's downstream from TikTok. It's all the TikTok teens there.
And indeed, it's also that newspaper headlines and headlines of not of just newspapers, of all media outlets, are themselves driven by the need to, by SEO needs, right? And even the writing of the article, has keywords thrown into it. So it's completely instrumentalized and driven towards the attention economy.
Yeah. So all of those things, all of those aspects are important, I think. So in addition to the point about infinite regress that Alex mentioned, kind of the difficulty of this model of deliberative democracy is that it always kind of keeps on throwing up new conditions, more talking about talking, and it becomes, in fact, it is kind of a model of the highly kind of policed and regulated woke kind of surveilled, internet vision of discourse. I guess that's important. But the other part of it also is, I think that the risk is that it becomes just a kind of a rubber stamp. So when you have this kind of idealized template, which has to be constructed of what deliberative democracy is, once you have it and you've kind of carved out the space for it around all of these tremendous kind of conflicting forces and impulses that happen around it, it becomes just, you have people their views in the in the citizens assembly or in the focus group or whatever. They air their views. The conditions are all equal for everyone. Everyone gets a chance to say something. Everyone is reflective and polite and respectful of everybody else's opinions. And it's this highly kind of manipulated environment. And so then it becomes just but it meets the criteria for what counts as legitimate discourse according to Habermas's model. And then it simply becomes this kind of rubber stamp for decisions that have been made elsewhere effectively. And I think that danger is built into the way in which it's conceived of. And so And this is why I think representative democracy is still kind of more appealing, just in a very, even on a very kind of superficial reading, is precisely because it builds out from interests. People come with their partial kind of demands and interests to the public, and they try and make the case for them. Whereas in deliberative democracy, there's always, or the model at least that Habermas sets up of it, interests are seen as kind of contaminating and polluting. They're always coming in from the outside, yeah, kind of subversive and damaging, and need to be somehow kept outside. Whereas representative democracy is about crystallizing those interests in such a way that you build a coalition, find allies, universalize a particular claim by saying everyone's interest can be folded up within it. And so it seems to me a much more kind of open-ended and inclusive vision, in fact, than Habermas's, which is, inclusive and vigorous, but in very tightly controlled parameters.
Yeah, I think one thing I probably should have clarified to listeners is what this book doesn't do and what you might expect it to do if you took seriously the idea it's a reboot of the 1962 book. Habermas dates the emergence of this changed public sphere to the turn of the millennium, but what he doesn't do is write a several hundred page book looking at all of its different forms and looking in particular at the sort of the sort of social groups who are, as Phil, you were sort of talking about there, are able to kind of, through these processes of this new public that's created, or these sorts of interactions, are able to kind of generate their own views of society, of politics, of what the public is. I mean, it could have been a more interesting book, I would say, if it had been that kind of historical. Habermas was looking back from the 60s to the 18th century. Can we look back from 2024 to the emergence of social media? I mean, can historians? I don't think I've read a really compelling book on the rise of social media, maybe because it's just too soon to have that viewpoint.
But there's no firm ground from which to argue it, right? Because it's already changing. So you might be, you spend 2 years writing a book and you're like well out of date by then.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh, I didn't have TikTok in this. And then it's like, it's all TikTok now. And who knows, by the time this podcast comes out, what will have overtaken
might have been banned, in the US anyway.
Exactly, yeah. But I think that is a real limitation, because without that specificity, historical, sociological specificity, it becomes very abstract. And that's where it kind of falls into these ideal modes of deliberation. And so it ends up being, I think, he does refer to some longitudinal studies in Germany, but it's like, he's got like 60 small pages to do it, rather than creating this whole historical narrative, looking at salons, looking at coffee houses, etc. So, yeah, okay. I do want to come back. Let's leave it. I'm not going to abuse my position as the chair, because there were, I think, three wider points, some of which we've already touched on, that I wanted to kind of to frame the kind of the implications or the political stakes of Habermas's book. I guess the first one is what he recommends for us to do. I think my, again, possibly crude, possibly reductive reading is that this is essentially a belated response to the end of history. So it is a worry that some kind of regulation on social media is required, because you have Brexit, which, quote, suggests that existing democratic regimes are being depleted. You have anti-lockdown protests, which in Habermas's view, the anti-corona demonstrations, which were staged in the libertarian spirit, were in fact being driven by authoritarian motives. You have this this worry that things have essentially gotten out of hand. The public sphere, bourgeoisie was able to exert quite a high level of control and produce this in their own image. That doesn't really happen. You have the Silicon Valley libertarians who are too open for a Habermasian kind of rational enlightenment liberal, you might say. So his conclusions, mainly, I already alluded to them, you have to produce this certain sort of media system in order to have deliberative democracy functioning. But he says, another quote here, maintaining a media structure that enables the inclusiveness of the public sphere and the deliberative character of public opinion and will formation is not a matter of political preference, but a constitutional imperative. So he's getting, you know, fairly hot under the collar for somebody who's who writes in the way that he does, quite a calm, logical German, not there's anything wrong with that approach. But this is, you know, this is the liberal kind of, if we can't achieve this through a political process, maybe we need to take it above politics and put it in as a constitutional imperative. And this is specifically that idea of regulating speech on social media so that it produces the right sort of public sphere. The second thing that I wanted to bring up, and you know, do jump in if you have anything that you kind of disagree with, or and the second one is a bit more open.
Can I just go on the first one? Yeah. Then? Might as well take the opportunity. I think Habermas is obviously confronted to a certain extent with an ironic realization of his vision, which is problematic, and I think probably why he writes this book, insofar as I already said, there's ever more communication, and it might not be the ideal situation in which Habermas imagines it. But at the risk of making a very obvious point, the discussion about social media has been over the past 30 years that it is, you know, from blogs onwards, message boards, etc., all the way to TikTok, talked about as a democratization of media, right? Which is very Habermasian, right? It's a democratization of media because everyone becomes an author. Now it turns out that when you're an author, you write for a newspaper, for example, you have a certain sense of responsibility, right? Because you have gatekeepers or readers or whoever somehow holds you to account. What there isn't on social media is any form of accountability. You can just say shit and then and be cynical. And when someone says that's not true, you go, ha ha ha, I can't believe that you took this seriously. It's kind of very common interaction that happens on Twitter, for example. So, you know, I don't want to be like, oh, we need to set up the rules, you know, about what right correct discourse is, because you get this into infinite recursion. But at the same time, you have to recognize that the good deliberation of the democratic type that we need does not really happen on social media, right? Broadly speaking.
Yeah.
Facebook at certain moments had that, or certain message boards did, but they were all within walls. And the episode with Cory Doctorow, I think, was kind of informative in this, which we did last year. But they were all good deliberation that happened within walls. When it's a free, completely open space, imitating a public square, it's a bordel. It's just like a mess, right?
Yeah, but what does it mean, imitating a public square? I mean, that would be chaos, you know, just people shouting at each other randomly.
But that's what social media is, basically, right? It's like it most of social media is unwalled and just a kind of a free-for-all where you shout into space, and maybe you have a conversation with someone and then someone else comes along and goes, hey, you're a fascist, you're a racist. And you're like, whoa, where the hell did you come from? Were you listening to what we were saying, right? So it's like that. If you were to put it into meat space, that's what it would look like. So anyway, my point about you know, to return to Habermas is just that, yeah, it's a kind of ironic realization of his vision, which hasn't turned out right. So he needs to then step back and go, okay, we need to put some... we need to put some rules around this thing, right? To appeal to some authority, yeah. to go, how do we actually have a democratization of media and to provide for, you know, true deliberative communication? And I don't know.
I think it's a good idea.
Sorry, it's like a liberal, nice liberal idea, which I'm like, sure, if that was possible, sure, I think that's good. But who are you going to empower to do that? That's the problem ultimately.
No, just to be clear, I think, again, it could have been a more interesting book if Habermas had accepted what you were saying there, Alex, which is that a lot of the discourse around social media is essentially that it is finally, we have this perfectly universal, perfectly inclusive public sphere. We have realized some of the preconditions potentially for, the realization of some of Habermas's theory of communicative action. You know, if we have the right sort of ability to speak in this new public square, which is, you know, potentially open to all and everybody can be an author, this is going to drive reason up and up and up and exponentially. But I don't think he really grapples with that aspect of, you know, I guess maybe it's more kind of internet boosterism that's maybe died off a little bit now, but there certainly was a point at which it was, yes, finally we have been liberated from the exclusionary newspapers to now the much more inclusionary
social media? Well, I mean, just to be clear, it has very much died off. I was reading a piece by Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist, which filled with various problems, but talking about the effects of social media, particularly on children. You know, he's been charting the effect on children's and young people's mental health, trying to, you know, quite conclusively decide or, you know, prove that it does have a negative effect. And I don't doubt that it does, but often the line of causality is a little bit more complicated than he makes out. But anyway, without getting into that, you know, he points out that, you know, this was all social, the social media boosterism, and just in general, the democratization of media boosterism was going on until around 2015 or 2016. Then what happens? Well, Trump, et cetera, right? And then the social media moguls, tech moguls pull back from it. And now you have things where, you know, obviously politics discussion is completely downrated on Facebook. If Instagram is now introducing this thing, incidentally, followers, if this applies to you, you should go into your Instagram and tell Instagram not to do this, which is, it hasn't affected my Instagram, but I think it's being rolled out in the US, where you can go to content settings and say, and says, like, its default now is don't show me political content, or like, yeah, in preference, don't show me political content. And you have to go in and specifically opt in to say, actually, no, I do want to be shown politics stuff. So, you know, wow. That's Meta doing that, right?
Just in time for the upcoming American election, coincidentally.
Indeed. But so the idea, it is now just purely entertainment platform. That's what it's meant for. And, you know, the idea that there might be some deliberation on there, even if it was imagined as fairly harmless deliberation in a very end of history mode, where like, oh, let's get everyone on Facebook and everyone can talk to each other. Great. And then they create revolutions. Okay. But they're fine because they're still in favor of American interests, and we can kind of color revolution them. Even if they aren't that, we can pretend they are, or our journalists will drop in and say, actually, this is about liberal democracy and people wanting to be members of the European Union, or to be like, just like the America, et cetera, et cetera. A point that Vincent makes very well in his book, Vincent Bevins. And then they find out that, like, you know, that as things progress, they're like, no, actually, this is combustible. We can't really control this, and this might blow up in our face. We're just going to just remove all the political content. Anyway.
I think that's basically right. Like 2016,
yeah,
boosterism afterwards. And this is, you know, I said it before, this is like a post-2016 book. Just to move then on to something which we talked about already, which is deliberation against it versus interest. Phil, maybe you've already actually kind of answered this this point, but I guess if you are rejecting, or as Alex put it, when in referring to my comments, dismissing, I mean, deliberation, then you have to probably come up with another model through which you move from isolated individuals to a political process of, you know, political will, whether it's general or otherwise being created and expressed. And this, yeah, I think one of the major candidates for this is interest. So I'll just set out a little very quickly what Habermas says, and then what I think is an alternative model. So Habermas says, quote, "The enlightening quality of the contribution of the mass media to the formation of public opinion requires a more or less informed pluralism of opinion filtered by the media system. This gives every citizen the opportunity to form his or her own opinion and to make an election decision that is rationally removed from his or her point of view." So the idea of being rationally removed from your own point of view.
Motivated or removed?
I said that is rationally. Did I say rationally removed? It is, yeah. Rationally motivated. And I'd written rationally motivated. So thank you for pulling me up Freudian on that slip. Because if it was rationally removed, then that actually makes my criticism of Habermas a lot easier. But I guess in some ways, for something to be perfectly rationally motivated, it does have to be in some ways removed. It is that kind of higher level of reason, just to recover my safe face a little bit there. But yeah, so look, you have enlightening mass media. This gives you a number of opinions. You know, you choose the best one. That Habermas's model.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I suppose we've covered it already. It's I suppose it's striking how little he seems, based on what you've been saying to us, George, how little he seems to have moved on, you know, or kind of absorbed kind of critiques or responses to his earlier model. So this idea of the, you know, that there is still the possibility of this kind of brilliant bourgeois kind of enlightened idea of public engagement that can somehow be kind of deposited from on high by a media, you know, that's sufficiently sophisticated and diffuse and safe from manipulation and instrumentalization, what have you, and this will kind of lift up citizens into this enlightened realm. You know, it just doesn't seem it's so patently artificial that it, you know, it makes you wonder whether or not the whole point of the model is in fact to think more about the ways in which you construct it than the model itself. You know, so if this is what we want to get through, then we need to think about all these other things we need to do to get there, which demand, you know, kind of, you know, control of the media, surveillance, certain kind of modes of socialization and education. And it does make you think whether, in fact, there's kind of a bait and switch in the way in which the very idea is kind of formulated.
But quite possibly. I guess one thing I did want to, since we have discussed this anyway, was just to recognize that the mediating institutions that, you know, previously might have enabled individual level interest to be catalyzed, organized, mobilized, you know, there's we can't be quite so certain that these exist. The political party is a, you know, is not in rude health, if you follow the work of someone like Peter Mayer. And, you know, this is something which, Alex, you've written on, with this idea of the aperion, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. There is Anton Yeager, previous guest of the podcast, has written about this in his work on hyperpolitics. Previous guests of the podcast, Chris Bickerton and Carlo Invernetzi-Achetti, have written about this in Technopopulism. Phil, I could keep going on, but one final one. You and I and Lee Jones and Pete Ramsey wrote about this in Taking Control. Like, there is a challenge for a model of politics based in interest formation that the institutions which were there to link the people to the state, there's now a void, there's an aperion, a gap, and this leads to a kind of hyper-conflictual but desubstantialized form of politics. So, I mean, I don't want to say that I'm changing my mind after deliberation and now a deliberative Democrat, but I do recognize the real challenges in that alternative model. The final thing I did want to discuss is to give Habermas a little bit of, I don't know, it's one of those things where I'll give him credit by linking him to somebody who says some things that I do like, which I think is not a million miles away from what he's saying. So Habermas kind of concludes in a way by saying that, active citizenship requires a by and large liberal political culture consisting of a delicate fabric of attitudes and taken for granted cultural assumptions. And I thought, well, yeah, I actually agree with that. I think there is a, he though focuses on that kind of the media system more than the freedom of speech as a part of this political culture, a kind of normative value within it. So, I mean, I've been relatively critical of Habermas in this episode, but I would recognize that kind of million, I think I would characterize it as that approach that you need to have debate, discussion, battle of ideas, a kind of, you know, that sort of thing in order to avoid dead dogmas and promote living truths. You do, like, there is an important kind of infrastructure that you need to have in order to, you know, to have these kind of, I don't know, these, and that's not a deliberation though. I think it's about exposing people to alternative ideas and having arguments, but it's not required, I wouldn't say, in order for legitimizing political decisions. It's a good in and of itself philosophically rather than politically. So I don't know.
I think it's right. Yeah, no, I think it's right. I mean, I think it's very hard, I think, to understate the kind of the brain damage essentially that's been done by the by all sorts of kind of soft assumptions that are never, or really people even bother to explicitly articulate them. You know, like I was seeing the, I was looking, because I follow Aaron Bastani, the Namara presenter. I follow him and we're Facebook friends. And so he was putting on Facebook how he was interviewing the Conservative Daily Mail columnist here in the UK, Peter Hitchens. And the stream of kind of invective in the posts beneath was like, why are you interviewing this guy? Why are you debating him? Why are you legitimating his views? This kind of stuff is just, I mean, you know, kind of all the predictable stuff you can imagine. And it just, I find it, you know, the idea, the notion that the, you have nothing to learn, even if only how to make your own arguments better, from an opponent. You know, there's just the assumption there that nothing is gained except from talking to people you agree with about things you already have complete, you know, finalized your views on.
Well,
it's just astonishing how damaging that is, I think, to any kind of meaningful notion of being able to do anything politically, you know, make any kind of meaningful collective decision. And that is a real thing, I think. And so, you know, I agree with Habermas. So like you say, George, I'm sure there are, you know, it's not just a kind of a soft focus kind of, you know, a soup of indifferent mush, which we need in order to reconstruct this public sphere. But there are some elements of it which are vitally important and even structural, like, you know, like freedom of speech that comes with, you know, constitutional and legal aspects to it, as well as all the kind of the soft tissue packaging around those strong kind of pillars.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. I mean, I'm just to tack one thing on, I think, as we're coming to an end here also, is that it seems to me I'm increasingly of the opinion that a reconstruction of some sort of public sphere which hasn't entirely melded with the private, and of course that will take a very different form to what it took in the 20th century and the 19th century, if such a feat were, you know, if we ever achieve such a feat, right? You know, which is effectively the precondition for politics. It would be that I think it starts with some sense of putting up walls, right? Of you know, to take the analogy, I guess, of social media, of having a message board where it's people who are interested in the same thing. That doesn't mean you're not arguing with, you know, Peter Hitchens or whatever. But it's the fact that you are to assert that you're not just shouting across the public sphere, because I think that gets captured by the technologists of public opinion so quickly. It becomes kind of, it is unable to provide the process of, deliberation, rational will formation. It becomes the hyper-political and increasingly Schmidtian, you know, shouting match that happens. And to be able to reconstruct public sphere, I think you have to start kind of from small cells or, you know, walled off areas, whether it's people with the same political views or philosophical first principles, or it's people who have a certain disciplinary interest in terms of science or whatever it might be, and build out where from there, which are basically these walled off areas which are able to inculcate a certain ethos and maybe its own tacit rules of communication, which then build out from there. Because I think the attempt to go directly public is in a world in which media and the spectacle is ever more present, becomes, and not just present out there in the public sphere, but out right here in your mind and in your heart, right? Because it's the voices that you read on social media are in your head all day long if you're on social media. So it's that to kind of pierce through that that way in which discourse is completely flattened and intercedes into every little area of life. You have to kind of wall things off and start from there. I don't know what exactly that looks like, but I think that would be my starting position.
Well, I mean, it may or may not be a coincidence that this episode is indeed paywalled, and it produces us, you know, a smaller group of people who hopefully can, hopefully didn't find this to be, as Phil put it, a soup of indifferent mush, but actually to be somewhat interesting. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we need to discuss books that we agree with and get a lot out of, and ones that we think are more symptomatic. And I think this is probably in the latter category. So next book, Philip.
Yeah, so the next book in our reading club is Isaac Deutsch's biography of Stalin. It's quite old now, in fact. Decades, 20th century classic. I'll explain more the choice and what have you when we come to it. It'll be our reading club book for May, but gives you an opportunity to go out and buy it. It's an excellent book, and it fits two of our themes that we've chosen for this year, which is Rise and Fall of Nations and Russia, past and present. And needless to say, Uncle Joe is still, significantly baleful and important figure to continue considering and thinking about. So that's what we'll be doing next.
Yep. And then after that, just to give you some visibility on what's coming up next as well, after that, we will be doing, I'll be introducing Dmitry Furman's Imitation Democracy, which is also about Russia, but about contemporary Russia and how the Russian political system, post-Soviet system, has been set up. So that's kind of feeds into a little bit about the intelligence in the public, but a lot about Rise and Fall of Nations, and indeed about Russia, most obviously. We're hitting all our themes at once, like hitting them on the head, like gophers popping out of holes. Anyway, we hope you've taken plenty from this. I know I have, and I'm pretty sure George and Phil have likewise in discussing this and in looking back at Habermas's work and his contemporary intervention. And we're obviously interested in what you make of this. Please leave your comments on Patreon, and we'll try to address them in the next reading club. So we keep this in a little club in our closed off, walled off area where we can continue this discussion.
Build that wall,
right. Exactly. We'll get Mexico to pay for it. All right. That is it from us for now. Catch you later. Bye-bye.